We'll commission the first edition of the Wren Report containing content from the 2008 Hamvention in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to this edition of the Wren Report, available via terrestrial dial-up at 773-358-7845. I'm Byron Lee, KC9-EEK. Now that all of the Wren crew has had a chance to catch our collective breaths, we're ready to launch a new batch of excerpts from the just-completed Dayton Hamvention, so let's get started with the first. As has been tradition for the Wren Report for years, the first excerpts gleaned from the Hamvention are from the always-packed FCC Forum.
My name is William Cross, as many of you know. I work in the Mobility Division of the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. The Wireless Telecommunications Bureau is the office in the FCC that is responsible for oversight of the amateur service. On the air, I'm W3TN. With me today is the Commission's Special Counsel for Amateur Radio Enforcement, Riley Hollingsworth, and he'll be talking about the enforcement activities in a few minutes. In the Mobility Division, we handle the day-to-day administration of the amateur service and some of the rulemaking activities that affect the amateur radio service. The division also has staff members in our Gettysburg, Pennsylvania office. The Gettysburg staff is the staff that handles most of your applications. They handle other licensing matters, and they deal with the Universal Licensing System, or ULS, as it is known. Within the Commission, other bureaus also make rules that affect you. Our Office of Engineering and Technology handles spectrum allocations and equipment issues. Our Managing Director's Office is the office that handles matters related to fees, such as the fees for the vanity call signs, Debt Collection Improvement Act matters, the need for those things you see called FRNs or Federal Registration Numbers comes through our Managing Director's Office. Today I want to divide my comments into two main areas. First, I want to talk about some proceedings where the Commission has issued a decision, and secondly, rulemaking requests that have been filed with us, but which are pending resolution by the Commission. The past year has been kind of an interesting year because it's been a fairly quiet year on the regulatory front. We haven't had any big rulemaking items come out. We have wrapped up a couple of ones that were pending, and it doesn't look like, at least in the near future, there will be anything else coming out. Obviously, at this time in the year and for the next few months, we're going to be very much involved in the national elections and politics. Basically, it's a very good time to be flying below the radar. And that's where ham radio is right now in terms of the big picture. We're below the radar. The first major decision I want to talk about was the reconsideration item that came out in 2008, in February of this year, that was the decision in the no-code proceeding, docket 05-235. No rule changes were made in that decision. As most of you know, the big part of that decision was that it eliminated the Morse code requirement for operator licenses. Now, two individuals petitioned for reconsideration of this decision. One individual argued that Morse code proficiency requirements should be retained for the amateur extra class license so that amateur operators can act as a strategic reserve because there is no assurance that voice or digital modes will even be operationally viable in future emergency communications environments. The Commission turned this request down because there was no showing that eliminating the telegraph proficiency requirement will affect national security or emergency communications. Remember that when we had a Morse code requirement in the federal regulations, that requirement came from the international radio regulations. Prior to 2003, there was an international requirement that for any operator that had HF privileges, you had to prove that you could, quote, send by hand and receive by ear texts in the international Morse code. After 2003, the international requirement disappeared. The requirement was never based on emergency communications capability, national security, or the unreliability of other types of communication systems. The other individual that requested reconsideration wanted us to reopen the comment period because he encountered difficulty in getting his comments and reply comments into the electronic comment filing system. The Commission turned him down because many of the 3,900 comments and reply comments expressed the same views as he did, so the substance of his views was considered. And when we checked ECSF, his comments were in there. The second item that I want to mention is commonly referred to as the Miller Order. This is an order that was released May 7th. It dismissed a petition for rulemaking we received from Mark Miller in 5RFX. This petition requested three different things. First, that we change the definition of data that's in Part 97 of your rules to delete language that he had requested we add in 2003 and which we did in a 2006 order. Second, he wanted to limit the subbands that automatically controlled digital stations are permitted to transmit on to only those subbands that were specified in Section 97.221. And lastly, he wanted to amend the rules to divide the CW RIDI data bands into 1.5 and 2.4 kilohertz segments. The effect of these changes, when taken together, would have been, as he said, a small number of wider bandwidth modes, including PAC-TOR 3, would no longer be authorized. End of quote. Translating that into English, what he was asking for was bye-bye WinLink. Don't get me wrong here. WinLink as a communication system seems to have become the Brussels sprouts of ham radio. You either love it or you hate it. And trying to bury it under ketchup or hollandaise sauce hasn't changed the basic like or dislike for WinLink. Most of the controversy here seems to swirl around how certain licensees use it. Some use it for a radio email system. Others use it for getting weather maps while they are on sailboats in places the brave dare not go. Others use it for their personal business activities, such as buying and selling stocks. These uses are really a Section 97.113, a prohibited communications question, not a technology question. The rules apply to the control operator of the station transmitting the message, not the WinLink system. As we have said until we are blue in the face, in the amateur service, we do not license or regulate systems. We license stations. And it is the station licensee that is responsible for the proper operation of the station. If it's your call sign on the transmission, it's your responsibility. The request that we limit the subbands that automatically controlled digital stations are permitted to transmit on to only those specified in 97.221 was curious because the rules, as they are today, limit transmissions from these stations to a bandwidth of no more than 500 cycles, or hertz, on frequencies authorized for RIDI and data emissions outside of those automatically controlled subbands, when a locally or remote control station is interrogating that automatic station. If the idea behind this request was to limit these stations to the subbands to minimize interference, we were not persuaded that limiting stations that were transmitting in response to interrogation by a station where there was a control operator present would cause increased interference, because these stations are already limited to a 500 hertz bandwidth. We also noted that the recurrent limit in the rules is less than the limit that was requested in the petition.
You're listening to the first of several excerpts that you'll hear on the RAIN Report from the 2008 Dayton Hamvention FCC Forum, featuring William Cross, W3TN, who is employed in the Mobility Division of the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. We'll conclude our first excerpt from his talk in a moment. This is the RAIN Report, being subsidized by Merle Heinlein, KB9NOH. You can read his bio on QRZ.com. This is the RAIN Report.
The third item that came out had to do with 2 meters. We received a request from two hams out in California, Ken Chafin and Leon Brown. What they wanted was for us to change so that a little more spectrum, 300 kilohertz, would be authorized for repeater stations. Currently, repeaters can use 3 of the 4 megahertz in your 2 meter band. They claimed that additional spectrum was needed for repeater stations because some amateur repeater stations have begun certain digital communications protocols, and digital voice operation is incompatible with the existing analog operations because digital voice users are unable to determine if a desired frequency is in use by an analog station. Inadvertently, they said, digital systems can cause harmful interference to analog systems. They also claimed that coordinating groups have been unable to separate analog and digital voice repeater operations because the available repeater spectrum in the 2 meter band is fully occupied by existing analog systems. Now, as I mentioned, repeaters are prohibited from using two 500 kilohertz segments of the 2 meter band in order to minimize harmful interference to other amateur service stations and operating activities. Believe it or not, some licensees use 2 meters for things other than repeater operation. The petition was turned down because their request would likely result in increased interference to other operations such as packet, moon bounce, and simplex type operations. This request also raises questions about the frequency coordinator's role in frequency management. Frequency coordinators are groups that recommend receive transmit channels, and they also recommend associated operating and technical parameters in order to avoid or minimize potential interference. Coordinators can create more channels by, for example, requiring before they coordinate a repeater that a narrower than 25 kilohertz bandwidth be used. They can establish that narrower guard bands be used, or that a repeater not be installed on a mountaintop where it ties up a channel for half the area of a state. Coordinators can set aside certain parts of a band for digital systems, if you all are willing to stand for it. They can refuse, under recommending associated operating parameters, to coordinate closed repeaters. And they can pull a coordination recommendation from a licensee if the licensee doesn't comply with the terms of the coordination. Coordinators also should be sure the systems they have coordinated are still using the channels before they tell you that your system can't be coordinated. From what I have heard, in some areas of the country, there are an awful lot of paper repeaters and an awful lot of out-of-date coordinations. Another thing that you need to remember when it comes to repeaters and coordination is that coordination is not required to put a repeater on the air. Coordination only becomes relevant if there is interference. If you can find a channel that is unused, the rules allow you to put a repeater on it. If a channel is coordinated to a closed repeater and you can use it without causing interference, you may. Coordination doesn't establish a squatter's right to a frequency or a right to exclude others. Just as there is no I in Army, there is no my in all frequencies are shared. The claim that the 2 meter band is fully occupied has to be looked at very carefully. Many times, the band in a particular location or at a particular time is only fully occupied on paper. Another group of petitions we received last year asked for changes in the station identification rules. We addressed these petitions in an order that came out in July last summer. One petitioner, basing his request on local repeater operations, wanted the once every 10 minute part of the rule changed to once every 30 minutes. We put this out for comment to see how you all felt about it. We got over 100 comments, and the overwhelming majority of you expressed the belief that the current rule properly balances the burden of requiring the station to transmit its call sign with the convenience of those receiving the transmissions. The request was dismissed. Another petitioner requested that we change the station identification rule back to what it was in the late 50s by requiring a station to transmit its call sign and the call sign of the station it was communicating with at the beginning and end of the message. And he wanted us to require the use of specific words, such as this is on phone or DE on CW when identifying. Again, we got over 100 comments. Most of them opposed the petition. We agreed that increasing the frequency of station identification as he proposed was unnecessary. It would be burdensome and could lead to congestion at times, such as during contests or during a de-expedition. The petition also did not demonstrate that revising the station identification requirement as it requested would address the primary problem of the petitioner. His claim was that many amateur operators do not identify their stations timely or at all. Again, this was based primarily on repeater operations, this time in Texas. The petition was dismissed. QCWA wanted certain letter combinations reserved so that stations may be identified as that of a veteran. We found the requested rule change was not needed because amateur radio operators who are current or honorably discharged members of the military already could identify their stations as QCWA requested. The present rule permits a control operator to include an indicator with the call sign, subject only to the limitation that the self-assigned indicator not conflict with any other indicator specified in the Commission's rules or with any prefix assigned to another country. So that petition was dismissed also. The last petition I want to mention is one that we received from a group that called itself Hams for Action. It wanted us to take another look at the 1985 PRB decision and subsequent requests to expand its scope. It proposed that the Commission preempt from CC&R's antennas only when the amateur operator is an emergency communications operator, and it proposed specific guidelines to define reasonable accommodation. Their proposal was denied because the distinctions it claimed did not address the Commission's primary reason for excluding CC&R's from its limited preemption policy, and that is that CC&R's are private contractual arrangements that the Commission is reluctant to interfere with. As the Commission reiterated in 2001, it is reluctant to preempt private parties' freedom to contract unless it is shown that the private agreements will seriously disrupt the federal regulatory scheme or unless there is strong countervailing reasons to do so. So where do we stand on PRB 1? In 2001, after the ARRL had made three unsuccessful runs at the goal line, the Commission said the scope of the limited preemption policy of PRB 1 for amateur radio stations remains applicable only to regulations of state, county, municipal, and other local governing bodies, and is not applicable to homeowners association bylaws and Architectural Control Committee regulations. It also said, however, should Congress see fit to enact a statutory directive mandating expansion of our reasonable accommodation policy, we would expeditiously act to fulfill our obligation under the congressional directive.
You've just heard our first excerpt from the 2008 Dayton Hamvention FCC Forum, which features William Cross, W3TN, who works in the mobility division of the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. We'll bring you more of his talk next time. Just a brief note about the Hamvention. While attendance was down, many of the inside exhibitors had few complaints. It seems that those who wanted to buy something were there, while those who typically attend for other reasons opted to stay home. Nevertheless, the only rain that you could find on Saturday and Sunday during daylight hours was at booth 404, Hap Not Found, the rain booth. Heartfelt thanks go out to the Dayton Hamvention for its generosity and hospitality. Likewise, a big thanks goes out to Gateway 160-meter radio newsletter producer Vern Jackson, WA0RCR, who was instrumental in setting up, maintaining, and dismantling the audio equipment and cabling for the Rain Report. Hap wishes to thank Merle Heinlein, KB9NOH, Shirley Roberts, N8LX, and her hubby, Lynn, N8LK, for their hospitality. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2008. Rain. All rights reserved. Now for the Recuperating Rain Crew, I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK, bidding you all a very 73 from all of us at Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network. www.therainreport.com